Welcome to our third session on mental health, mind and body. Today, we welcome Tom Knier from Samaritan Counseling Guidance Consulting, who happens to work in the office at Westminster Church. So this is really a great privilege to have Tom here this week and next week. Today, the topic is our self-care. Do I need a permission slip for this? It promises to be a great session with much that we can take home with us on this cold, wintry day. So now I turn it over to Tom and remind people that when you have a question or comment, if you're on Zoom, feel free to unmute and ask your question. Welcome, Tom.
Thank you very much. Good morning, everyone. Those in person and those in virtual presence, those who are barely present, I'd like to turn to prayer. Lord, on this Lord's Day in which we cease from our work in order to worship and to honor, to praise you, to celebrate your resurrection, we do ask that you would send your Holy Spirit to be with us, to open our minds and hearts, to receive more of your light and wisdom and guidance. We truly desire that you would be more at the center of our lives and transform us in our emotions, our minds, our hearts, our spirits, that we might be more like your Son, Jesus. In his name we pray. Amen. All right. I don't have to admit people to the Zoom, right? Somebody else is going to do that. All right. So you've had the two heavy hitters, and now I come to bring cleanup. They had done an excellent job. Ed with the area of emotions and Graham with the area of spirit. And so today we're going to talk about self-care. Just real briefly about myself. I originally am from Cleveland and left there to go to college, met my wife there in Steubenville, Ohio. We raised our seven children there and now have 15 grandchildren. But we moved to Pittsburgh in 2002, and so we very much feel at home here. I've had three careers before, well, as actually in parallel with mental health. I was an administrator, a pastoral administrator for a number of years, higher education administration, and then social service administration. So this is my retirement gig, and it's a privilege. One gentleman told me, this is when you're a free agent for God. So I get to do things that I've always wanted to do. But right now, the privilege is serving at Samaritan Counseling, which is a terrific organization. And I'm very blessed to be part of it. So today we talk about self-care. And why do I say, do I need a permission slip for this? I feel like most of us feel a little sheepish or maybe even guilty about taking care of ourselves. It seems to be the last thing on our minds. And unfortunately, that is more common than I would hope. And so when we talk about self-care, it's not a self-serving, self-centered type of thing. It's an essential thing because actually it covers all the dimensions of our health and well-being. The emotional, the spiritual, the mental, and the physical. When you take care of yourselves, you're going to be more emotionally healthy, more spiritually healthy, mentally and physically healthy. So this sort of is the umbrella over all the things that we're talking about in this series. But when you think about that, you have to picture, so what is a healthy person emotionally, spiritually, and mentally? What do they look like? Well, an emotionally healthy person has no anxiety, no depression, no anger, no moodiness. A spiritually healthy person, no doubts, no lack of faith, no sin. Mentally, no mental problems, obsessions, distractions. Physically, no weight problems, no disease, no disabilities. Do you see the little word at the bottom of that page? Not. That is not our goal. That is not the picture. Unfortunately, in the therapeutic field, I feel like over the years, sometimes we've given people that impression. They come to counseling and say, I'm experiencing anxiety, I'm experiencing depression, and I just want to get rid of it. Well, yeah, if it's disturbing and disrupting and interfering with your daily function, yeah. But to feel anxiety and depression, to have bad days and so forth, that does not make you unhealthy. So our goal is going to be a little different. The goal of self-care is to give ourselves the resources needed to give of ourselves. To me, that's a healthy person in all the dimensions. Why? Because the Lord said in both Matthew and Mark that the greatest command is to love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your mind, with all your strength, and love your neighbor as yourself. Doesn't that sound like the whole mentally healthy person that we're talking about? But you can't give what you don't have. We need to receive in order to give. And scripture calls us to put others ahead of ourselves, not instead of ourselves. I think we get that mixed up sometimes. We're so focused on giving to other people, we just completely ignore ourselves. And something that we hear a lot about these days, being the best version of ourselves, I would say it's not just to be the best version of ourselves, but to do the best version of ourselves. And I'm not talking about justified by our works. I'm talking about having our actions be the fruit and the expression of our love. When Jesus himself talked about the final judgment, he described it in terms of serving those that are hungry, needy, homeless, naked, in prison. So the goal really of our self-care is to be that kind of person that can give of ourselves to others and to live up to that call. So I'm going to start with emotional health because that's where Ed started, and look at the kind of self-care that we might consider to be emotionally healthy. Relaxation and restoration. Why do I start there? Because it's another one that we don't do very well. In our society, we are so busy, our calendars are so full, our need for stimulation and so forth is so ubiquitous that we don't really know very well how to relax. And if we can't relax and get restored, again, that energy and that ability to give goes down and down. So I'm giving you some suggestions here. The first one is recreation, which I'm calling recreation because it's supposed to do that, right? Mm-hmm. What are my suggestions? Things like going to the park, visiting a museum, kayaking and so forth. And why am I suggesting those? Because they're non-competitive. If you talk to people and you think about it yourselves, yeah, I need some recreation. And so maybe you go out on the golf course and you come back, I am so frustrated. That doesn't sound very restorative. Or if you are a tennis player, I have a couple of clients who tell me that that's some of their most intense times of the week is when they're on the tennis courts. So yes, there is such a thing as recreation for exercise and so forth, but something that's non-competitive is recreating. And when you're in the park, a museum, kayaking, you're out in nature, you're slowing down, and it can be restorative. Hobbies like collections, reading, photography, embroidering, jigsaw puzzles, or jigsaw projects. I know lots of folks that love their jigsaw. So those types of things, again, can be relaxing and restoring. Entertainment, concerts, the right kind of concert that's going to be enjoyable. Movie, again, the kind of movie that's not a Friday the 13th, but a movie that's going to be restorative. Dinner out, maybe a day trip, a weekend away. Things like this can be very restorative. Today is the Lord's Day, and it's supposed to be a day of rest. I went to a training once a number of years ago, given by a wonderful woman who is a nationally known speaker and author. And in the question period, people said, you travel all over the country, you're constantly writing, you have your own institute out in Baltimore. How do you stay fresh? And she said, well, I'm a lifelong devout Jew, and I take the Sabbath seriously. And she said, on Friday night, I shut everything down. And she meant cell phone, television, computer. She said, I literally shut it down, and I spend 24 hours in Sabbath rest. And she said, that's how I do it. Well, that convicted me, and I felt that I needed to take much more seriously the Lord's Day as a time of rest. And the last one is diaphragmatic breathing and progressive muscle relaxation. Now, that doesn't fit with the rest of the stuff that I just gave you, but I'm actually going to spend more time explaining this one because it's free. It doesn't cost you any money. You can do it every day. And the benefits are things that you may not be aware of. According to the folks at the Cleveland Clinic, relaxation techniques have benefits such as slowing your heart rate, lowering your blood pressure, slowing your breathing rate, improving digestion, maintaining normal blood sugar levels, reducing activity of stress hormones, increasing blood flow to your major muscles, reducing muscle tension and chronic pain, improving concentration and mood, improving sleep quality, lowering fatigue, reducing anger and frustration, and boosting confidence to handle problems. Wow. If they had a commercial on television that said, we have a drug that does the following things and listed that, they'd be a billionaire company. This doesn't cost anything. And yet it has so many benefits. The website that I put there at the bottom is actually a progressive muscle relaxation sample. So you can go to that website, and it's a YouTube video, and there's a calming voice that talks you through it. And a progressive muscle relaxation is simply starting at the top of your head where you tense your muscles and then release them. And you go through every muscle group all the way to your toes. And you can't really do this in the office because people will be a little concerned. If you sit at your desk and you start out going, release, release, release. So you want a private area, but it actually is going to walk you through all those muscle groups and to the point of relieving stress, tension in the body, and then all these benefits. So that's one technique. This one, I'm putting some of these up with all the words, not because I expect you to read it and to go through it. I know that some of you will be able to access this recording later, and that way you don't have to take notes. But I do want to walk you through this one. People assume they know what diaphragmatic or that breathing, you know, oh yeah, I know how to breathe. Well, what happens when we breathe when we're tense or anxious is we end up taking much shorter, shallower breaths, which puts more pressure on the lungs and gives you less oxygen and the whole bit. So I'm going to walk you through this, okay? The diaphragm is the most efficient muscle of breathing. It's the large dome-shaped muscle right at the base of the lungs. And if you breathe with your abdominal muscles, you're going to move the diaphragm to give a more effective use of your lungs. So what are the benefits again? It strengthens the diaphragm. decreases the work of breathing by slowing your breathing rate, decreases oxygen demand, and uses less effort and energy to breathe. This one you can do sitting on a bus, sitting at your desk, sitting at home, and it is sitting. So you guys are already sitting. So you can do this with me actually right now. You're sitting comfortably, your knees are bent, you're kind of relaxed, your shoulders, your head and neck are relaxed, right? You're gonna put one hand up here on your upper chest and the other hand down here, right below your rib cage, okay? When you breathe in, you're gonna be breathing in through your nose. So you take one breath and you should feel your stomach going out, okay? Let's do it. Okay. So you felt that, right? When you took it in, your stomach came out, your hand on your chest didn't move much. All right, so we're gonna do it again, but this time on the exhale, you're going to purse your lips and use your abdomen, your diaphragm to push it out. All right, so let's go in and then out. So you should have felt your diaphragm go all the way in. And you notice that the exhale was much longer than the inhale. That's very important because you want to exhale the carbon dioxide and inhale oxygen. So the amount of oxygen in should be shorter so that the carbon dioxide is going out, okay? You can do this, as it says, 5 to 10 minutes every day. The Cleveland Clinic recommends this even more if you have COPD because they want you to build up your diaphragm and the correct breathing. But it has all those benefits. So you don't have to have a gym membership and spend a lot of money doing all kinds of physical therapy. You can relax and restore yourself with all those benefits that we mentioned just by doing diaphragmatic breathing every day. Why is that a benefit for emotional health? Well, if stress is lowered, if you're able to slow your heart rate and your breathing and so forth, you're a more calm person, you're going to have more capacity for dealing with stress, handling problems. So diaphragmatic breathing, progressive muscle relaxation, freebies for emotional health. All right, I got to grab my phone so that I know what time we're dealing with. Okay. And by the way, as Ted said, if there's any questions along the way, just interrupt. Raise your hand. Yes. How do they get the PowerPoint?
If you'll send it to me after we're done, they will post it along with the video.
There we go.
Post it in the form of a PDF.
Okay. Very good. Other questions on Zoom? They're either sleeping or they're mesmerized by the presentation. All right. Self-care for spiritual health. Now, of course, Graham already covered a lot of this, and he said there's another series that he's going to be doing, so I'm not going to spend a lot of time on this area, but the first thing that he mentioned, and I would say the most important one for spiritual health, is prayer. And I call it an appointment for God. Why do I do that? We make appointments for the things that are most important, right? If you're going to see the doctor, if you have an appointment with your spouse, if there's a meeting that you need to get to for work, it's in your calendar. There's a reminder on your phone. You know you're going to do it. You're not going to miss it because it's a priority. If prayer is a priority, it's sort of like an appointment with God. And I have, over the years, literally, until it became a little more part of my normal schedule, I would write it in with everything else in my planner, an appointment with God. And I think it was, I can't remember how many years ago, I had a preacher say, this, Christianity is not primarily a set of doctrines and beliefs, although it has those. It's not primarily a moral code and a way of life, although that's part of it. It's not even primarily a religion. Christianity is a relationship. And that has stuck with me. When I read the definition of Christianity in the Oxford Dictionary, it says it's the religion based on the person and teachings of Jesus of Nazareth, or its beliefs and practices. Well, that's also true. It's based on the person of Jesus. But there's a huge difference between knowing about Jesus and knowing Jesus. If I tell you there's an expert on Abraham Lincoln that's coming to speak next week, has spent his whole life studying Abraham Lincoln, knows everything that you would ever want to know or care to know about Abraham Lincoln, and gives the presentation, you'll be impressed with the breadth of knowledge. But he's never met Abraham Lincoln. And he wouldn't know how Abraham Lincoln might think about or react to certain things. And that's the difference. Prayer is not something that helps us fulfill an obligation. It's to grow a relationship. And so it's first of all a dialogue. Sometimes we think of prayer as everything that we do. But self-care is also receiving and hearing. That dialogue is going on. Not that we hear, obviously, an audible voice, but God speaks in the silence. God speaks, and getting to silence is one of the challenges of prayer. First, there's just being at a place where it's quiet. That's not easy to find. But then, after the external noise has died down, now we got to address the noise internally. All the stuff that's going through our mind, all the concerns, all the distractions, all the demands, that noise is going on. And to try to quiet that noise takes a while. And then we're able to encounter our God in a dialogue. Meditation is a beginning way to start the conversation, in that we're dwelling on scripture or spiritual reading that is inspiring, that's challenging us. But then it's also, again, an opportunity for a dialogue on the things that we're meditating on. Gratitude. One of the most underestimated aspects of therapy. And you would say, well, wait a minute, I thought we were talking about spiritual well-being. There is growing data and material in the therapeutic field that talks about the benefit of gratitude. Psychologists find over time, feeling grateful boosts happiness and fosters both physical and psychological health, even among those already struggling with mental health problems. Studies show that practicing gratitude curbs the use of words expressing negative emotions and shifts inner attention away from such negative emotions as resentment and envy, minimizing the possibility of ruminating, which is a hallmark of depression. Does gratitude reduce stress? People who are grateful feel less pain, less stress, suffer insomnia less, have stronger immune systems, experience healthier relationships, and do better academically and professionally. Overall, it can boost your mental and physical health. Okay, again, if I advertised that I had a pill that would do all that, couldn't have enough of them. And yet, gratitude. And this is research apart from any spiritual nature or biblical perspective. This is what therapists are finding in their treatment of clients, that gratitude has that kind of power and that kind of resource. So having gratitude be a part of our spiritual life and part of our daily life, you can be grateful for even the most mundane things, and it has that effect. I've been trying to do some more concrete things in my daily life in this regard. So I'm kind of walking through the day with more or less success, having my mind focused on things like this. Lord, I thank you for hot showers. I cannot imagine a cold shower. I thank you that I have kind of an unlimited source of water. I can run this shower for a half hour if I want. I would never do that, but thank you for my body. Thank you that I can do the things that I can do. Thank you that I have this home that keeps me warm in the winter. I'm sitting at breakfast saying, I'm thankful for the chicken, the pig, and the cow that contributed to my eggs, cheese, and ham. For the man who grew the oranges. So there's a way that you can do this throughout the day. And not only does it focus on the positive, as it says in that research, it shifts you away from negative, because if you're really being so stressed by all kinds of anxiety, and of course, in this day and age, anxiety is probably the number one thing. I mean, I have more people coming to my office, even who have never had any issues before in this regard, say, I just can't get past this COVID thing. I try to limit my exposure to the news. I try to not talk about it so much with my friends, but I'm just getting more and more anxious. I'm worried about exposure. I'm limiting myself and my activities. And some of it's required, of course, and is wise. But what's happening is the levels of anxiety keep rising. And so we need more and more ways to know how to manage that. Not to eliminate it, but to manage it. Because again, an emotionally healthy person is free of anxiety, but knows how to manage it and knows how to be able to continue with their daily life and their functioning. So again, there's so many ways to do this. And scripture talks about rejoice always, pray constantly, give thanks in all circumstances. Well, it's got therapeutic background. It's got biblical truth, giving thanks in all circumstances. And journaling is just really kind of tracking this dialogue that we have with God and the things that we're grateful for. The more that you journal and write down on a regular basis, those things that you're hearing, those things that you feel like are things that you're grateful for, you look back and it starts helping you to understand more and more about who you are and who God is, and that there's a lot more that you've been learning than you realize. I mean, when people say, how you doing? Fine. So what's new in your life? Oh, nothing. I mean, that's sort of the standard response. But when you're journaling, you actually have something to say. You can say, you know what? Actually, in the last couple of months, I've really been growing in my understanding of suffering and how to manage suffering and how to support other people in suffering. So whatever it is that's being spoken of in your personal life and your prayer, that journaling can be a huge help. That's all I've got to say about self-care for spiritual health. Like I said, Graham's going to cover or has covered much more of it. But self-care is also important for mental health. And I list there things that you're going to say, okay, yeah, it's about time to leave. Sleep, exercise, nutrition, I already know all about that. You can't tell me anything new about that. You might give me some help with coping skills and professional help. I don't need it. So we're good. Well, I'd like to talk a little bit more about how this works, how these things actually impact mental health. Dr. Don Posner, and again, this is, I don't know if you can even read all that, but Don Posner is my resource. He's an expert, has been doing this for 30 years in the mental health field, treating sleep disorders, and has a tremendous amount of material that I use with clients, and he continues to be a resource. He's actually one of those unique men that If you email him, he emails right back. And I was not prepared for that. So sleep disturbance is actually a criterion for many mental and emotional disorders. The idea is treat the disorder and your sleep will improve. So since depression, anxiety, and many others will list as one of the criteria, is that person having insomnia, having trouble, or sleeping too much, whatever. He found out that the opposite is also true. If you treat the sleep problem, the disorder improves. So he had evidence, growing evidence, that as his clients were able to get more effective, restorative sleep, depression decreased, anxiety decreased. His research was so convincing that the American College of Physicians of Clinical Guidelines has now made it the number one, the first choice of treatment for sleep disorders. Not sedatives, not sleep pills, not melatonin, not anything else like that. It's in their guidelines that cognitive behavioral therapy for insomnia is the first treatment of choice. It was pretty convincing. And so his material is very important. So how much sleep is adequate? If you say to me, I've always heard that 8 hours of sleep is the goal. He says, that's not entirely true. You need as many hours as it takes to get restorative sleep. That's different for each person. A minimum of 4 hours of uninterrupted allows you to get through all the 6 stages of sleep. And we won't get into what the stages are, but I'm sure you've heard of REM sleep, rapid eye movements. So that's usually what people think of as the deepest stage of sleep. It's actually not. That's one of the ones that indicates you're coming out of the deeper stage. But he says you have to have at least 4 hours uninterrupted to get that full benefit of restorative sleep. Now, the national population MODE, and remember, MODE isn't average. MODE is the number that was reported most frequently. So the national MODE is 7.5 hours. However, the prevalence of acute insomnia, meaning short, so if you have insomnia for 3 or 4 days, the prevalence of acute insomnia is 35% of the population. The prevalence of chronic insomnia, which is obviously much longer, 10 to 15%. So now you've got 40 to 50% of the population that is at some time struggling with insomnia. So the 7.5 hours is a little misleading, right? As we age, and at least I've heard about this, as we age, the interruptions in sleep to get up and use the restroom might increase. There's also the notion that as we age, we need less sleep. There's a whole set of studies that have been done that shows that's actually not accurate. It's the way that we process our sleep. And there's a book written that I'd recommend if you're in my age group called Successful Aging that talks a lot about this. It's written by a neuroscientist and very well done. So anyhow, adequate sleep's important, very important for our emotional, mental, spiritual well-being. What happens when you don't get enough sleep? Slowed thinking, reduced attention span, worsened memory, poor or risky decision-making, lack of energy, increasing anxiety, depression, and irritability. When it talks about poor or risky decision-making, I can tell you, if I've had a bad night's sleep, I always turn to my wife and say, I hope I don't have to make any important decisions today because I wouldn't trust myself. So that's just a general way of thinking about it. Johns Hopkins research makes it more specific in the medical area, the physical area. When there's sleep deprivation over time, it increases your risk of high blood pressure. There's a 48% increase in developing heart disease, 3 times more likely to catch a cold. It'll age your brain 3 to 5 years. I don't know how they measure that, but 33% increase in dementia risk. You have more cravings for sweet, salty, and starchy foods, and a 50% higher risk for obesity if it's less than 5 hours a night. So they have a little caveat there. 36% increase in risk for colorectal cancer, 3 times higher risk for type 2 diabetes, less active immunity protectors, which are called natural killer cells, and impaired judgment in noticing its effects. I love that one because there's all these things, but you won't notice it if you're sleep deprived. So Johns Hopkins gives us the insight into it's not just our emotional health and our spiritual health. We're not just going to be a little bit better functioning during the day. It has all these medical benefits to avoid these problems with sleep deprivation. So that's why I say adequate sleep is a big deal. So what can I give you for sleep hygiene? All these things. You may be already aware of most of them. The first one is one you might not have thought of, clock watching. If you have a clock in your bedroom, on your nightstand, if you have a clock that you pass on the way to the bathroom, he recommends, Dr. Posner recommends actually flipping it over, putting something in front of it, because as soon as you notice what time it is, it introduces concern about, oh my gosh, I have to get up in 2 hours, or I can't believe I'm up already. I thought I'd been out for 4 hours. And so it creates a stress which alerts the brain, of course, and then makes it harder to fall back to sleep. So he said, it may be hard to get used to, but if you set your alarm, you know when you're getting up, you don't need to know what time it is. The lighting in the room, obviously, to be as dark as possible, use darkening shades. He says night lights are fine, book lights are okay when you're reading. As quiet as possible, even if it means using maybe white noise machines, or if you have a humidifier or a fan that's already going, that's good. Anything that's a steady type of noise, or even earplugs if it blocks out the disruptive noises that are unexpected. Pets are okay in the room as long as they're not in their bed, in your bed with you. Food, avoiding heavy meals close to bedtime. But on the other hand, hunger can disturb your sleep. So he says, yeah, a light snack can be helpful before bedtime. Carbohydrates such as crackers, bread, cereal, and fruit are probably the best. Liquids, we just talked about bathroom visits. So a full bladder is likely to lead to disrupt sleep in the middle of the night. Try to cut down on the amount of fluids in the evening. And he's pretty specific, no more than 4 to 6 ounces in the last 4 hours before bedtime. Exercise, should you exercise before you go to bed? Is it okay in the evening to have exercise? He said it's a little bit variable from person to person. It can be used to keep you alert until bedtime if you're trying to stay awake, but usually, you don't want it too close to bedtime. Alcohol. A lot of us feel like, yeah, a glass of wine or something can relax us. Alcohol is actually a stimulant and can interfere with staying asleep and can also have an effect on frequent wakening. Nicotine is a stimulant also. It's been demonstrated that when chronic cigarette smokers quit smoking, sleep improves significantly. And lastly, a buffer zone. It helps to set aside the last hour before you go to bed for some quiet, relaxing activities. Try to avoid doing work projects from your job or things that can be agitating right before bed. And by the way, he also says that if you do wake up in the middle of the night and you feel like you can't get back to sleep after about 10 minutes, he said it's much better just to get up and do something mindless, do something that's not productive, something that would kind of glaze over. So he said, better to get up and do something like that for a half hour, and then when you feel tired, go back to sleep, than it is to keep tossing and turning and saying, I really need to sleep, I gotta sleep. Because again, as soon as you start saying, I have to sleep, you're stimulating your brain to be much more conscious than sleep worthy. So again, the importance of sleep. The importance of exercise. We're winding down on our time. Why is exercise important for emotional, mental health, spiritual health. I don't have to get into all the physical benefits, but I want to at least define what the Department of Health and Human Services says are good guidelines, that we should be doing aerobic activity and strength training if we can. Getting at least 150 minutes of moderate aerobic activity or 75 minutes of vigorous aerobic activity a week. But then the caveat, being active for short periods of time throughout the day can add up to provide health benefits too. So whatever you do, taking a walk around the block, walking the dog, whatever you're doing is also going to help. Strength training to address the major muscle groups at least a couple times a week, using weight or resistance so that your muscles are tired after 12 to 15 repetitions. For moderate, I always wonder when people say, well, do moderate aerobic exercise, what is that? His suggestions are things like brisk walking, biking, swimming, mowing the lawn. But more vigorous aerobic exercise are things like running, heavy yard work, basketball, aerobic dancing. And then as far as strength training, using weight machines if you have them, or your own body weight, meaning just calisthenics, heavy bags, resistance tubing or resistance paddles in the water, or activities like rock climbing. I don't know why rock climbing got selected as, I don't think that's the majority experience of most folks. One of my sons became a rock climber and started doing the free, what do they call it when you're not using the things? Anyhow, he got into more high risk climbing, but then he got married. So he hasn't been doing that anymore. I think she might have had an influence on that. So the exercise from a therapeutic point of view is very important. Why? It actually gives us good endorphins. Notice this, natural cannabis-like brain chemicals, endogenous cannabinoids. Who knew there was such a thing? But these are natural brain chemicals that can enhance our sense of well-being that happen when we exercise. It also takes our mind off worries, so getting away from the cycle of negative thoughts that can feed depression. So exercise in itself has a physical benefit with the endorphins, but it also has a mental benefit of distraction. In addition, some of the psychological and emotional benefits, gaining confidence, you're meeting exercise goals or challenges, getting in shape, making you feel better about yourself, more social interaction, being with other people, walking with other people, going to the gym with other people. And then coping in a more healthy way, doing something to manage your depression is a healthy coping strategy. And so the point is, and this is all from the Mayo Clinic, by the way. So the Mayo Clinic is the source on physical exercise has emotional and mental benefits and are going to increase our sense of well-being. So who knew? Sleep, exercise could have a benefit on all these other areas. We're going to wrap up with this last one, nutrition. I'm not going to talk about the physical benefits. Everybody reads all the time about supplements and good eating and eating greens and portion size. So that's all out of my realm. I just want to talk briefly about the expert that I rely on for this called Judith. Her name is Judith Matz. And she talks about attuned eating. Why is that important? She said that we need to learn to eat from the inside out. We need to be more aware about our internal signals and follow those. Because she says we eat for three reasons: hunger, pleasure, we like food, and emotional eating. My dad in 1976 had gone through Weight Watchers all his life. He was 6'4 and 300 plus pounds and then lost 100 pounds and was biking all the time. So he now is a beanpole biking through town. One day during dusk, he's crossing a street and he gets hit by a car, thrown up on the windshield, shattered, all kinds of bones, brain injury. They didn't think he would survive. He does survive, but he permanently loses his sense of taste and smell. He starts gaining all the weight back after recuperation. My mom is saying to him, "How is it that you're still eating more if you can't even taste it or smell it?" He said, "I remember what it tasted like. And it makes me feel better," because of course he was depressed and anxious and had all kinds of stuff that he was dealing with. And that's when he was told that he would still have to do the things that he was doing before to lose weight. So we do eat for these three reasons. So her point on attuned eating is this: pay attention to when you're physically hungry. We usually don't do that. You know, okay, it's lunchtime, or, well, it's dinner, where do you want to go out? We don't ask anything. So she starts out by saying, how do you know when you're hungry? What do you notice? And when you start asking yourself that question, it's not that easy to answer. How do you notice when you're physically hungry? Pay attention to that. And then identify what you're hungry for and try to match it with foods that satisfy you. Sometimes you crave something salty. Sometimes you crave something with carbs. Pay attention to that. She said, that's kind of your body telling you a little bit on what you need. And then pay attention to fullness. This is probably one that we most ignore. Give yourself time after you have a portion on your plate. Don't have all the food sitting in front of you so that you can keep piling on. Have your portion. When you've consumed that portion, give yourself 5 minutes. Usually you're going to find out that you're full. You might want a tad more. But her point is that pay attention to the inside out, your hunger, why you're eating. And when you notice, like I do, if I'm watching TV at night and I'm grabbing a bag of chips, it's just because I want something crunchy. I'm not hungry, but I'm sitting there watching a game while I'm eating chips. So her point is to be more attuned to eating, and we'll find ourselves in a healthier place. So again, this has to do with our emotional health, because again, if we're eating because it makes us feel more content, or I'm feeling anxious or angry even, and so I'm eating, important to notice and to address the emotion that's being met by the food so that you don't have to rely on the food for it. Okay. I got lots more for next week, but this is a good place to stop. Questions. Wait a minute. Do I have? Yeah, that's it on the slides. Questions, comments. Nobody interfered, interrupted. I'm disappointed.
On the sleep and light issue, my better half keeps grabbing my cell phone away from me an hour before bed because she's read somewhere that particular kind of light is particularly troublesome if you want to go to sleep. Is that true? Is there the computer lights? Is that a particularly bad light to be looking at just before you go to bed?
Blue light can be stimulating. Yes. It's interesting because a reading light behind you to read, not a problem, but the blue light screen does. Yes.
Question. The theme here has been self-help, but if you sit and watch TV at night at any point, there's 10 different drugs where chemicals, and really the chemical versus a self-help type approach to mental issues. Is that something you're going to get into, or do you have a view on that?
Say it again.
Well, all the prescriptions you can take for mental health.
Oh.
All the ads you see in commercials where they're encouraging you to talk to your doctor to get this
right.
Pill or that pill. This has been mostly a self-help theme. Do you have any thoughts or comments on the balance between chemical versus self-help?
Yes. The question, and I don't know if everybody gets it. They hear that on Zoom, don't they?
Yes, they do.
Okay. So, the question about chemicals. There certainly are prescription medications that are very helpful in terms of treating mental and emotional issues. They are monitored by a psychiatrist. They can be monitored by your PCP. It's hard for a PCP to stay on top of all those things. So it's always better if there's a psychiatrist, but it's very hard to get an appointment with a psychiatrist. So a PCP that can prescribe is very good. Those also, though, need to be monitored because those affect people differently. Somebody will say, oh, I took Prozac and it was the best thing since sliced bread. The next person said, I took Prozac and I was on edge all the time and couldn't possibly. Everybody sort of responds differently. So you do have to have it monitored, not just prescribed. Then in terms of non-prescription things, there's, I don't know if I brought that with me. No, I have that. I can bring that next week. I actually have some things about melatonin and other non-prescription things that are touted that I can definitely comment next time.
But the broader thing is, then there's a time for both. There's a place for both. Or your view on that, self-help versus?
Yeah, there's definitely a place for it, as long as you understand it this way. Because I tell my clients this all the time. An antidepressant or an anti-anxiety medication doesn't cure you. An antidepressant doesn't make depression go away. What it does is it addresses certain chemicals in the body that are going to raise your capacity to manage and cope, so to speak, so that there's energy, motivation, a better sense of well-being, so that you can address the bigger issue. All the data says that antidepressant medications versus therapy versus antidepressants and therapy, the third one has clearly the best track record.
With that, I'm going to not cut off the questions and discussion, but thank you and stop the recording for now. But say that we can continue as long as you have time and as long as people have questions. Thank you so much, Tom.
Thanks, Ted.